This is State of the Union, the DC 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. DC 37 is the city's largest union of public workers with 125,000 members and 50,000 retirees. We're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Sundays at 8 p.m. We rebroadcast Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We are also now available as a podcast on iTunes. Simply go to your podcast app on your iPhone or iPad and search for DC 37 State of the Union. And there are more ways to stay in touch with your union now than ever before. You can follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can check out our website, www.dc37.net. And every month, you should keep a lookout for your union newspaper, the Public Employee Press, in your mailbox. Tonight, we welcome two-time George Polk Award winner and former New York Daily News columnist Juan Gonzalez, who has written a new book called Reclaiming Gotham, Bill de Blasio and the Movement and America's Tale of Two Cities. Mr. Gonzalez, welcome to the show.
Oh, Chris, it's my pleasure to be here.
Welcome back to the show. I think you've done the show before. Let's talk about the book first, because it's an interesting time in the city of New York, and there is an election coming up, and we had until the last 3 years, we had 20 years of Rudy Giuliani and Mike Bloomberg. And Bill de Blasio is another piece of cake. I mean, he's not. Let's talk about the differences between where Bill de Blasio was trying to go and where Giuliani and Bloomberg took us.
Well, I think the big thing to understand about the Giuliani era and the Bloomberg era is that both of these candidates, they were not Democrats. Both started out running initially as Republicans and attempted then to identify themselves more as independents. Giuliani ran twice as a Republican. Bloomberg always managed to get the Republican line, but always tried to identify himself more as an independent political figure. So the reality was, though, that both of them espouse what I call in the book the growth machine approach to cities, which is that the way a city prospers is by basically incentivizing the maximum profitable use of the land of the city through subsidies to developers and to businesses to stay in the cities, and basically they follow what I call the neoliberal approach of the growth machine, which is basically to privatize government as much as possible, sell off the public commons, as much of the schools, the public schools, the parks, and the other public amenities as possible, under the guise that the private sector is always more efficient than the bureaucracy of old-style governments. And so basically that's what both Giuliani and Bloomberg tried to do. Giuliani clearly emphasized more law and order and curbing crime, whereas Bloomberg spent more time trying to incentivize the private sector. But the reality is that under both, the ordinary New Yorkers were left out. And increasingly, housing became too expensive for ordinary New Yorkers. The public schools were under assault as charter schools began to grow dramatically, and many public schools were closed. There was the workers of the city had trouble getting decent contracts, especially in the tail end of the Bloomberg years. They couldn't get any contracts. And so you had a whole vision that the way a city prospers is when the elite of the city prosper. I think the big change of de Blasio and post the Great Recession and post Occupy movement that really changed the conversation in the nation about income inequality is that de Blasio took the perspective that a city prospers when you raise the economic level of the mass of city residents as much as possible. And so many of his reforms since he's been in office have been aimed at strengthening the economic situation of working class New Yorkers and the city's poor, and whether it's paid sick time for low-wage workers, or whether it's universal pre-K, whether it's the rent freezes that have been occurring on rent-stabilized apartments throughout the city, or whether it's the fair settlement of union contracts with all of the unions, some of which had gone for 5 years without raises, others 3 years. All of this is aimed at raising the economic level of the mass of the people of the city under the theory that as the economic level of the bottom part of the city goes up, those people will spend the money in the city, and that will lead to prosperity.
Juan Gonzalez is the author of Reclaiming Gotham. We're talking about Bill de Blasio and the movement to end America's Tale of Two Cities. Listen, what you were just describing sounds to me, it's the old story of trickle-down economics, right? The theory behind all this is if we give the wealthy more and they do well, somehow that's going to get down to the rest of us. And that is an economic outlook that Republicans, conservatives, Ronald Reagan took to the bank for many years. And what I'm amazed, because I was living in Washington, D.C. for the first 6.5 years of the Obama administration. And while it's true that D.C. is in a bubble and can, doesn't always understand what is happening with the rest of the country, New York City, in the 6.5 years that I was gone, became this incredibly unaffordable place to live. And I was amazed when I came back how there was no room for working class folks or middle class folks to actually have a manageable life in this town. And that didn't happen by accident, right? I mean, that was...
Right. No, the big increases came during the... I mean, there had been increases during the Giuliani years, but the really sharp escalating price of housing in New York really happened under Bloomberg. And it was as I explain in the book, it was not just a pure operation of the free market. But in reality, there was an extensive city policy of seeking to promote the gentrification of neighborhoods. One of the things that they did, of course, I highlight in the book that land policy, what a city does with its land, is crucial for the development of a city, because obviously the land is always limited. There's only a certain amount, and more people come into a city, the fight over how land will be used is important. So, for instance, the city's planning commission under Bloomberg's commissioner of city planning, Amanda Burden, rezoned huge sections of New York City. They often downzoned or kept existing zoning in more wealthy homeowner communities that already existed. But then they upzoned many minority communities. By upzoning, that means that you allow for more commercial development in what might previously be, let's say, a limited height in places like East Harlem or Crown Heights or the South Bronx or some of these other neighborhoods. So they would upzone. What does upzoning mean? Upzoning, you are creating more space for developers. But obviously, the city space doesn't go laterally. It goes up. So the higher you allow buildings to exist in New York City, the more money developers can make. So by upzoning or rezoning and then upzoning many of the distressed neighborhoods in the city, they were in essence inviting developers to come in and take advantage of their new ability to build. And of course, no developer in his right mind is going to build affordable housing or low-cost housing when, for a few extra frills and granite countertops and stainless steel appliances, they can charge luxury rents or luxury prices. So that's basically what happened. The city, through its use of land use policy, incentivized developers. And of course, then they had all of the 421A tax abatements that if you build, you can get extra height in your buildings if you agree to do 20% affordable housing. Well, that still means you're building 80% luxury housing. And even many of the 20% requirements were not mandatory. They were sort of like an incentive, and they weren't enforced very strictly. So basically, it was the Wild West for building luxury-priced housing, while the majority of New Yorkers, I mean, I think at this stage, 50% of New York renters pay more than 33% of their income in rent.
Right.
And an amazing one-third of all renters in New York City are paying 50% of their income just for their rent.
Well,
so that means they're essentially working to pay the landlords.
Absolutely.
That's all they do.
And I remember when the mythology was that all New Yorkers who have their apartments for more than 5 years were living in quote-unquote rent-controlled apartments that were causing landlords to go broke, and because we needed to bring some sort of fairness to the landlords who for years had to maintain these buildings occupied by people who lived in quote-unquote rent-controlled apartments that were paying $70 a month for 18 rooms on the Upper West Side. That was a mythology, wasn't it? I mean, that was...
Yeah.
It amazes me, and you are one of the smartest observers of the scene, especially in New York City, you know, how I don't think that these people, you know, maliciously decided that they were going to wipe out the middle class, but they certainly thought that, you know, building big buildings and charging huge rents was a solution to something in New York City. And I'm not clear now, as we've watched this, what that was supposed to solve other than the landscape of the town. I mean...
Well, I think one of the things it did, and I think Bloomberg was pretty open about this. I remember having a conversation with a community leader who... from the Williamsburg section of Brooklyn, who attended a meeting with Bloomberg and raised this issue of how the city's policies were leading to driving low-income folks out of the city. And the person said to the mayor, where are people supposed to go who can't afford these rents? And Bloomberg said, matter-of-factly, well, they're just going to have to leave. and that Bloomberg really did promote the influx of what some people call the creative class, other people call the managerial class, basically science and high tech, information technology employees, most symbolized, for instance, by the new Google, the huge new Google building in the Chelsea section of Manhattan, but by many other tech firms that moved, by the Cornell Center that he helped finance on Roosevelt Island, that basically Bloomberg saw the future of the city in attracting highly educated technology and scientific STEM workers, basically. And there has been a huge influx of these folks, especially when he began to privatize government services and began doing all these IT contracts that, again, attracted people that were making huge salaries to come and work privately for city government. So basically he saw the future of the city in attracting this highly educated workforce. The problem is that many less educated people continued to move into the city, and because there were all these low-wage jobs that these high-tech people needed people to work for them, you know, whether it's in restaurants or in service industries or delivering their food from Fresh Direct or wherever they order their food from, so that And it was the low-wage workers that couldn't find places to live. I mean, just to give you one example, in the book I call it One Housing Study. Between 1990 and 2000, which is roughly the Giuliani era, the median rents in New York City increased by 1.9% in that period. But during the Bloomberg era, they increased by 18%.
Wow.
And
wow.
That's citywide.
Wow.
When you go to the gentrifying neighborhoods, places in Harlem, Upper Manhattan, the Bronx, and North Brooklyn.
Oh, the number must
there,
be huge.
The rents climbed by just 3% under Giuliani, but by 30% under Bloomberg. So there was a systematic sharp increase in rents in precisely in the neighborhoods that were largely black and Hispanic as the city's development incentives took hold and more private equity folks and others started buying up these old buildings and figuring ways to get people out, the old residents out, so they could bring in the newcomers.
We're talking with Juan Gonzalez, who is the former Daily News columnist and the author of Reclaiming Gotham, Bill de Blasio and the Movement to End America's Tale of Two Cities. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today. 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
We're back. This is State of the Union, the DC 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. We're on Sunday nights at 8 p.m. and we also broadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. You can download us on your iPads as a podcast. Just search DC 37 State of the Union. We're talking to Juan Gonzalez, former Daily News columnist and the author of Reclaiming Gotham, Bill de Blasio and the Movement to End America's Tale of Two Cities. The Daily News just got sold. And
yeah.
It got sold. I don't quite understand. I assume Mort Zuckerman just wanted to get it off his plate or whatever. And so there's no real dollar value attached to it. It's the new company is going to take over obligations that the company that the Daily News has. Is that correct? I mean, how is that?
Right. Yeah, it's basically going to take over the pension liabilities, which are the long-term debt of the company to its unionized workers, the drivers and the pressmen and the other folks who still have long-term pension obligations. I think people don't remember probably that Mort Zuckerman didn't buy the Daily News for much money. He actually spent about $33 million to buy the paper off the original the Maxwell Empire, which was the Robert Maxwell who his empire owned the Daily News at the time that Zuckerman took it over in 1993. So he didn't pay much for it to begin with, but he assumed a lot of liabilities in terms of pension liabilities, which have been reduced over the years as the Daily News cut its workforce dramatically. But it's still, and the paper operated in the black for many years. until the last, I guess, 5-6 years, when as all the other newspaper companies started hemorrhaging circulation and ad dollars, it's also been operating in the red. So, and I think Mort Zuckerman basically is a lot older now, and he just wasn't able to justify, I guess, the losses that he was incurring year in, year out in the overall operating expenses of the paper. So he basically needed someone to take it over and assume the remaining pension liabilities. So that's why you have, surprisingly, the return of the old Tribune company, because Tribune is the company that originally owned the
right.
paper for many years. Only now it's called Tronc. It's changed its name. So Tronc, the successor to the Tribune company, now owns the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, and the New York Daily News, the papers in the three largest cities in America. I find it particularly ironic because back in 1990-91, I was one of the leaders of the last major newspaper strike in the country, the Daily News strike of 1990-91 against Tribune. And at the time, Tribune was claiming that unless they were able to break our unions, that they could not justify keeping the paper because it wouldn't make a profit, it would have to close. Well, here we are, 27 years later, the Daily News continued to function all those years under a new owner, and for most of that time made money. And now the same company that claimed it would not be able to survive is now owning it again.
Seize the opportunity.
Buy it.
Right.
It's a real irony that the Tribune Company, after we drove them out of New York, is now back owning Daily News.
What do you think this all means for, I mean, as a working journalist, as someone who has spent their entire life practically telling stories about the city and about the world in which we live, where do you think this goes from here in terms of, I mean, I was on the train this morning. I was the only person reading a newspaper on the train.
Right, yeah. The young people don't read newspapers. They get most of their news from Facebook,
right.
actually, from their friends sending them articles that they find. And that's how young people get there. They get it on their phones, and they get it largely through Facebook and a little bit through Twitter, but obviously Twitter's limited. So Facebook is the main way that most young people get their news these days. They don't even watch TV or cable. Forget about reading a newspaper. So that's the bad side, the depressing side. However, stories are still being told. And, you know, it's not necessary for good journalism to be on a paper, although it's a lot easier to read. And you also get more variety on the pages of a newspaper than you do in the stream of a website. But the stories can still be told. The problem is that all the news websites that exist today are always trying to hire their reporters on the cheap. They want young people. They don't want to give benefits for the most part. There are a few exceptions. I mean, look at the Huffington Post. The Huffington Post basically is supplied free content by all of their writers for the most part, except for the people who do the editing. That's the problem. How do you maintain a large enough group of reporters to report not only the national news, because there'll always be companies like CNN and CNBC and Fox and the New York Times that'll do the national news. But who is going to do the local news in your town or city? Who's going to report on your local school board, what's going on with your zoning board, what's going on with your city council, and how is the land being used in your neighborhood? That's what's going to be missing more and more as these local newspapers collapse, because everyone is migrating to the web, and the web is not making enough money to justify hiring full-time reporters at decent salaries with benefits, with health benefits, and some kind of retirement plan. So that's the advertiser-driven model of journalism in America is collapsing. So the question then becomes, how will the American people get their news, especially their local news? And it's especially true in the state capitals. You know, back in the day, the Daily News, the New York Times, all these newspapers would have 7, 8, 9 people working in Albany, or, you know, the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Daily News, a bunch of people working in Harrisburg. But now all of these state bureaus are are pared back to almost nothing. So nobody is watching what's happening in the state capitals of America, and where a lot of corruption exists, as we've seen here in New York City with all the indictments. But the press is not leading these investigations. It's usually some prosecutor because there's no reporters watching how the state governments are spending their money.
And that really is a serious problem if you're thinking about accountability, which seems to have – it's amazing how a story will blow up as stories have never blown up before in terms of, you know, the something going viral. But it will last for, like, a short period of time, and then you're on to the next big thing. And the important stuff, as you say, is, like, the policies that are put in place that are able to go under the, you know, cover of night or the cover of darkness, which, you know, kills accountability.
Right.
So what do you think about the replacement model, this idea that there are nonprofit organizations that try to raise money, that they get grants, and that go out and do journalism? Do you think that that's a valid model for the, I'm thinking of ProPublica, I'm thinking about the Marshall Project.
Right, ProPublica, right. There are definitely some excellent nonprofit models developing around the country. But they're still, for the most part, they're still oriented at big national stories. They're not oriented at what's going on in the local communities. For that, you need a ProPublica-type organization in every city in America, just concentrating on what's happening in these local areas. So, yes, these attempts to create sort of centers of independent nonprofit journalism are excellent, at least in the absence or the decline of investigative journalism overall. But it still doesn't solve the systemic problem that we are basically losing the local reporting. I mean, at one point, AOL tried to do something that they claimed was going to be a replacement. They called it Patch. And they must have hired like 5,000 people to basically become reporters and editors of local websites in different like neighborhoods and towns across America. But within a couple of years, when they didn't get the advertising they expected, they started closing all these operations.
Right.
So it was sort of like a quick hit attempt to make money off of local news reporting. And when it didn't provide the money, they shut most of it down. So this is the problem. How do you replace the local newspaper? Because throughout American history, we've had a local media. Every little town has their weekly, and once you get to any kind of medium-sized city, you have at least one, two, sometimes three dailies. And so you had people who were covering the local government, the local crime situation, what was happening at the local level, and that's all been basically eviscerated.
Juan Gonzalez, I knew this half hour was going to fly by. I knew that we needed to do a whole show with you. I thank you very much for your time. Juan Gonzalez is the author of Reclaiming Gotham, Bill de Blasio and the Movement to End America's Tale of Two Cities, former Daily News columnist and a New York City icon in journalism, man. It's been a pleasure knowing you all these years.
Well, likewise, Chris. Interviewing you numerous times on stories.
And here we are
years later, still kicking.
That's right. They ain't going to get us, bro. Thank you very much. That's just about all the time we have for the show this evening. One last announcement. The DC 37 Organizing Department continues to hold lunchtime meetings at various sites across the city. For more information about how you can become more actively involved in District Council 37, please call 212-815-1095. The producer of this show is Rudy Orozco. The engineer is Andrea Minocchio. I'm Chris Policano. Until next time, ciao.